and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us on Alaska Public Media as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
This week, we're talking U.S.-Cuba relations with Charles Shapiro, former U.S. coordinator for Cuban affairs and one-time ambassador to Venezuela. We'll hear about the embargo happening in Cuba and learn about its effect on business and on Cuba's economy. While Cuba's former president, Fidel Castro, passed away on November 25th, this event was recorded on September 30th at the Hilton Hotel and was sponsored by the Alaska World Affairs Council. If you'd like to follow along with his presentation, you can find the slideshow on our website, alaskapublic.org.
Hello, welcome. My name is Lisa Falsco. I'm the CEO of the Alaska World Affairs Council, and it's such a pleasure to see everyone here today. And we have our special introduction today from a current friend of our speaker and former board member of the Alaska World Affairs Council and current U.S. Senator for Alaska, Senator Dan Sullivan.
Good afternoon, World Affairs Council members. It is my great honor to once again be able to introduce a good friend of mine who had the opportunity to serve with in the Bush administration. Now, a couple weeks ago, I had the great honor of introducing one of America's top spies, and I certainly hope you enjoyed listening to Ambassador Crumpton. Now, I have the opportunity to introduce one of America's top career Foreign Service officers who is a Latin American specialist, Ambassador Charles Shapiro. If you look at Ambassador Shapiro's bio, record of achievement, resume, literally there are very few American Foreign Service officials who have such depth, knowledge, and experience in certainly one of the most important regions of the world for the United States, and that's Latin America. If you look at all the hotspots, Cuba, El Salvador, Venezuela, he has served in all of these areas with distinction and so many other key areas to the United States. So Charles, I'm very sorry I'm not there to be with you, but I know you're gonna do a great job, and I want all my friends and colleagues at the World Affairs Council and fellow Alaskans to please give Ambassador Charles Shapiro a warm welcome, and I'm sure he's going to give an outstanding, interesting speech. Ambassador, over to you.
That's great. Thank you. Good afternoon. How are y'all? Good. And thanks, I need a copy of that to send my mother. I mean, and my staff, convince them a little bit. I think that's so cool. Anyhow, Dan Sullivan and I worked together in the Bush administration. He was Assistant Secretary for Economic and Business Affairs, and he did, I'm a career guy, not a political appointee, and we worked together really closely, and he was the author of an initiative to facilitate growth of countries, economic growth of economies of Latin American countries. That was the program was so good that when the Obama administration came in and Hillary Clinton came in as Secretary of State, they didn't modify it. And any of y'all who are involved in politics know this is the real thing. Didn't even bother to change the name, right? So. Anyhow, good. Thank you, Dan. And it's a pleasure being here in Alaska. Thank y'all. It's the World Affairs Council has just been terrific. And from Alyssa meeting us at the airport last night with a smile that was a mile wide, and it was quite clear who she was without need for a sign. I'm here to talk about Cuba. Part of my career at State Department, I was the director for Cuban affairs for the last year of the Clinton administration and the first year of the Bush administration. And then later, as Deputy Assistant Secretary, I was involved with Cuba again, but from the next level up. And after I went to Atlanta, became the, I'm actually not on the board, but I'm the president of the World Affairs Council of Atlanta. We've taken 5 trips to Havana and Cuba in the past year and a half. And so I've gotten to know Cuba very well, and that's what I want to talk about today. And so get those clickers clicking, and we'll see if any opinions change one way or the other. First of all, how many of you in this room have been to Cuba? Good. So that's, what, 4 or 5 people? That's terrific. So please, don't contradict anything I say. just bear with me here, and let's hope it's right. This is downtown Havana. And what do you notice about the building in the background? Besides the scaffolding, take it off, and what does it look like? It looks exactly like the U.S. Capitol because it was designed actually to be a copy of the U.S. Capitol. It's the Cuban Capitol. And the major difference, actually there was scaffolding on the dome at the U.S. Capitol the past year as well, but the major difference is every Cuban will tell you is our dome is 6 feet taller than your dome. So size counts, I guess, in some things. Anyhow, this is going to be on the radio. What I want to talk about is Cuba, the Cuban economy. What I have found out with the people that I have taken to Cuba is that folks are convinced that, you know, U.S. business is going to go to Cuba and there's just money on the streets and you can pick it up and make a fortune. And you will not be surprised to know that it is not that easy to make money in Cuba, not that easy to make money anywhere else for that matter, and that the challenges of doing business in Cuba are the challenges of doing business lots of places, with two added complications. That's the embargo and the embargo within the embargo, and that's what we're going to talk about today. Just a couple of things so that you've got an idea of Cuba. Cuba, obviously you recognize the island on the map. It's the size in square miles of the state of Pennsylvania, just stretched out. It has got, the population is about 11 million people. And the total economy of Cuba is the same as the economy of Hartford, Connecticut. Okay. Metropolitan Hartford, Connecticut. Let's be fair. So I mean that will give you an idea that it is in fact a very poor country. And here we go. So this gives you an idea: 11.2 million people, and a GDP of $81 billion. It's about half the GDP of the Dominican Republic, and the Dominican Republic is a poor country. And I'm guessing that you don't hear a lot on the news about the DR, and that over your dinner tables, very few people talk about the Dominican Republic, whereas people do talk about Cuba a lot. And the reason that they talk about Cuba is our long history of involvement there, which I don't think is that different from our long history of involvement in the Dominican Republic. But in 1959, two important things happened. One was that Alaska became a state. The other is that the Cuban Revolution triumphed, that Fidel Castro and his guerrilla army chased the dictator of Cuba, Fulgencio Batista, out of the country. And the Cubans refer to this as the triumph of the revolution, okay, 1959. And I'm going to try to say this in a way that is straightforward as I can. The Cuban economy is stuck. I mean, it is absolutely stuck. What economists will say is that the Cuban economy was overly dependent on the United States before 1959. After the Communist Revolution took over the country, it became overly dependent on the Soviet Union. And those of you who our chairman of history departments will remember something called Comic-Con, right? The communist... The Economic Cooperation Council. It was the economic counterpart to the Warsaw Pact, for those of you old enough to remember the Warsaw Pact, right? And essentially what it did is it divided up what countries were going to do, and they traded with each other using barter, so that all the buses were made in Hungary, all the jam was made in Romania, and all the sugar was made in Cuba. And so Cuba exported sugar to the Warsaw Pact countries, and, you know, economists have pored over this, and essentially Cuba got four times the world price for sugar from the Soviet Union, which is a good deal, right? I mean, if you could get four times the world price for oil, Alaska would be doing real well right now, right? And that was a huge subsidy. And then suddenly in 1992, the Soviet Union collapsed. All assistance to Cuba ended. And they went through, in 1 year, the economy declined more than the U.S. economy declined, not in the recession, but in the depression, okay, in 1 year. They suffered through a really tough decade in the 1990s. A friend of mine who's a writer at the Miami Herald published a book about the end of Castro was the title of the book. Everybody was just sure that Cuba was going to collapse, that Fidel Castro would be thrown out, and that there, you know, the thing was going to change completely. Obviously, that did not happen, and he blames it on the editors and the publishers, not on himself. That's what you do. But then Venezuela stepped in. And Venezuela, with Hugo Chavez, and I was ambassador to Venezuela, with Hugo Chavez as president, Venezuela began to supply Cuba with oil at extraordinarily favorable terms. So that these are all estimates because the data from Cuba is always suspect. But at one point, they were receiving 123,000 barrels of oil a day from Venezuela, essentially for free. Essentially for free. The quarter of it never even got to Cuba. The Cubans just sold it on the world market. So it was a huge subsidy for the Cuban economy. Now, if you've been following the news, you know that Venezuela is in very difficult circumstances now, and so they've cut back on the oil that they are providing Cuba, but it's somewhere around 90,000 barrels a day of oil that Cuba is receiving from Venezuela. And Cuba pays for it in doctors, medical technicians, dentists, sports coaches, ballet instructors, and advisors to the government of Venezuela working in Venezuela. And so, I mean, no money exchanges hands. And so you've got that, and I would argue that the Cuban motive in reaching a rapprochement with the United States, which started in December 17th, 2014, was Raul Castro figuring out that they were overly dependent on Venezuela and that Cuba needed to diversify its strategic relationships. And so that was their motive for essentially coming to detente with the United States. Now, the U.S. embargo was imposed on Cuba shortly after the triumph of the Cuban Revolution. So the revolution actually took power on January 1, 1959. The embargo initially was policy, was declared by President Eisenhower, later reinforced by President Kennedy. In 1996, the embargo under the Helms-Burton Act became law. Congress passed a law which Bill Clinton, a Democrat, signed into law. There was a Republican majority in Congress, but President Democrat signed the Helms-Burton Act into law, and it took policy and made it law, okay? And essentially what it did is it makes it illegal to do business with Cuba, to sell to Cuba, to buy from Cuba. for U.S. banks to process any exchange of money having to do with trade with Cuba, which is really complicated because all kinds of deals between, you know, let's say Germany and Japan end up going through U.S. banks, right? So if U.S. banks aren't processing it, if New York's not processing the exchanges, that makes it very complicated and adds to the cost of Cuba doing business. And the biggest problem is that we are 90 miles from Cuba, and we're the natural market for Cuban products, and we are the natural supplier to Cuba, and all of Cuba's pre-1959 infrastructure was, in fact, U.S. infrastructure, right? You know, the electric plant, the streetcars, the trains, the automobiles, the radio station. I mean, all of that equipment came from the United States. So Cuba had to live without that. So it's had a real impact on Cuba and has hurt the Cuban economy. And actually, the Cubans have an estimate of how many billions of dollars it has cost them over the years. Who knows whether that's an accurate number or not? I don't know. So that's the U.S. embargo. President Obama has asked Congress to lift the embargo, but Congress has to pass a bill to do that. And just like in 1996, we've got a Democratic president, Republican Congress, and the Republican Congress isn't about to do any favors to the Democratic president. That's the way politics works, no surprise. And so Congress has not acted to remove the embargo. What President Obama has done is sort of find Swiss cheese holes in the embargo, use lawyers to interpret an exception here, an exception there. But they're around the margins of the embargo. They're not dealing with the embargo itself. Okay, so that's part of it. The second problem with the Cuban economy, let me back up here. It's not me saying the Cuban economy doesn't work. Raul Castro, the president of Cuba, says the Cuban economy doesn't work. I mean, just objectively speaking, their economy is not functioning. So that's not an outsider being critical. It's what they say about themselves. And he says that because it doesn't work. The other problem with the Cuban economy is that they essentially have an embargo on themselves. And that embargo is called central planning, communist government, that means that, I mean, communism works no better in Cuba than it worked in the Soviet Union or than it works in North Korea or you name the country. And that also means that countries who don't have embargoes on Cuba, i.e. the rest of the world, don't invest in Cuba. The Europeans don't invest in Cuba. The Canadians have there's one Canadian company that owns a nickel mine in Cuba, but that's it. We talk about that, resources, y'all know, you go where the resources are to get the resources, right? Not to the countries where you want them to be. Even the Chinese do not invest in Cuba. And the reason is, and which in fact I would argue the Cubans do not understand having met with them, is that before you make an investment, you decide where you're going to get the best return on your investment. And the truth is, you can make more money investing in Vancouver than you can in Havana, right? You can make more money investing in Singapore than you can in Havana. And so businesses are making those decisions. I would argue make more money investing in Atlanta or in Anchorage than you can in Havana. And as a result, it is still 1959 in economic terms in Cuba. I took this photo on one of my trips there. That's the harbor that's right in downtown Havana. They're moving commercial shipping out of the harbor because the harbor's not deep enough to a place, a new harbor about 40 miles west of Havana. But what you see in the background is an oil refinery that actually was owned by Gulf Oil, those of y'all who remember Gulf Oil. And so it is cutting edge 1958 technology, and that's why it's belching out that big black cloud of smoke over Havana. The power plant in Havana, same thing, pre-1959 technology, it burns fuel oil to generate electricity, and there's a huge black cloud coming out of the generating plant. And in reality, almost all infrastructure in Cuba is the infrastructure of 1959. Now, there's some great things about that, by the way. Neighborhoods have not been torn down to build freeways. There are no strip malls. There's no CVSs, right? I mean, there's, the stuff you see looking out the window here doesn't exist there. And so in some ways, you have this beautiful, untouched city, which is, in fact, the oldest city in the Americas. They're going to have the 500th anniversary of Havana. 500th anniversary. Let me say 500th anniversary of Havana in 2019. It is an extraordinary place with buildings from the 17th, 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries. Buildings that look like they are in Europe, not to copy Europe, but because that's what you built then, right? That's what you built. It's a fascinating, beautiful, and frustrating place to visit, because what you see right now is the Cuban government sort of wrestling with how do they proceed? How do we make the economy grow while keeping what really are the three great, what they call the triumphs of the revolution, the great victories? One is there's equality. Equality of people in Cuba. More or less racial equality and more or less social equality in Cuba. Number two is all education is free. From elementary school through graduate school, all education is free. And if you're an Alaskan, I'm going to tell you, it's free for the student, it's not free for the state, right? So it costs. All health care is free, from the primary health care through the research institutes that are focused on cardiology or cancer or whatever in Havana. All health care is free to the patient. To the patient, not to the state, but to the patient. And what they're faced with is they can't afford it. The population of Cuba is declining. It's declining for a couple of... It is declining because people aren't having children. Not unlike lots of other countries, but people have fewer and fewer children. But it's declining because people are immigrating abroad. As soon as university students graduate with that great free education they've had, they leave. They try to leave. They want to get out. They want to go someplace where they can make more money, where there's more opportunity. And it is complicated. One of the benefit of great health care, public health care, not private health care, is that everybody lives longer. So Cuba has got fewer workers for each retiree now than it had 20 years ago. And 20 years from now, it will have even fewer workers for each retiree. So you extend the life expectancy, but you have people immigrating from the country and nobody immigrating to the country. Okay? And so that has put them in an economic box, which is going to be really difficult to get out of. And how you do it, I don't know. Actually, I do know. I've got some ideas. The Fifth Congress of the Cuban Communist Party met in April. For those of you who have studied communism and communist systems of government, party congresses are huge. I mean, this is the fifth party congress since 1959. It is the party congress that actually lays out the blueprint of where the country was going. There was great expectation that at that party congress, they were going to further open the economy of Cuba to foreign investment, but more importantly, open the Cuban economy to Cubans themselves. And we'll talk about this in a second, there are only 201 job categories in Cuba that you can go into in the private sector. Okay? I guarantee you that you know, within a mile of where I am right now, there's probably 10,000 job categories. So there's 201 job categories that you can enter into. Most of them in services, so barbershop, shoe shine, orange juice squeezer. Honest to goodness is one of the 201 categories. Restaurant, renting rooms in your home, okay? And there was this great hope that and expectation that it was going to spread, that they were going to open the economy further at the party Congress. And in fact, they did nothing. They said, we're going to stay the course.
You are listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA Anchorage. We've been hearing from Charles Shapiro, former U.S. coordinator for Cuban Affairs, as he spoke to the Alaska World Affairs Council at the Hilton Hotel in September. He's about to refer to a slideshow that you can find linked on our website at alaskapublic.org.
So what I'm going to show you now are, these are people I've met with. I took these photos, and they are the private sector in Cuba, okay? They call them cuentapropistas, which in Cuban Spanish, not in Spanish, but in Cuban Spanish, a cuentapropista is somebody who is self-employed. Cuenta means account, propista means yourself, so it's on your own, working on their own account, cuentapropistas. And as you can see, it's a shoemaker. I mean, that's who the cuentapropistas are, a cobbler, a shoe repair guy, not making shoes, but repairing shoes. This gentleman, Julio Alvarez, restores those fabulous 1950s U.S. automobiles. He buys them, and then he puts them on the road. I mean, he restores them and puts them on the road. I asked Julio, how long does it take him to restore a car? And he says, 8 months from start to finish. First of all, he says, only 10% of the ones that you see in the pictures are worth restoring, have enough original parts that they're worth restoring. His supply chain is apparently the mother lode for parts for 1950s cars is in Santa Ana, California, okay? And so he's got a guy in Miami who, a Cuban living in Miami, that he tells him, for this car, I need these parts. The guy orders them from Santa Ana, gets them shipped to Miami. Then they are brought in suitcases, because the private sector in Cuba does not have the right to import directly. So it's brought in suitcases, and then he pays the guy in Miami. He's angry that he pays the guy in Miami a 10% markup. I think he's getting a deal. Because, he's lived in Cuba his whole life. He doesn't really understand. And he says it takes him 8 months to restore a car. He said if there was a Napa or a Genuine Auto Parts in Havana, he could restore those same cars in 2 months. And so that extra 6 months and that bad supply chain is the cost of doing business in Cuba, okay? He also, let me go on. In the background, by the way, he only does General Motors cars. If you're old enough, do you remember that families were either Ford families or they were GM families, and his was a GM family. His dad was a Chevrolet mechanic. And way in the background, you can see a lathe that's a Craftsman lathe that belonged to his dad. You remember they had lifetime guarantees? And it still works, and he still uses it, right? So it's a pre-1950, remember I said the economy stopped in 1959? This is a pre-1959 metal lathe that he's using to make parts for the automobiles that he is restoring. Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, met with Julio Alvarez, and his photo was on the front page of the New York Times with Governor Cuomo, which I think is pretty cool. The woman on the left has a factory, and I've got quotation marks around it because her factory is three used sewing machines, two of which are pre-1959 sewing machines. She makes baby clothes. She's got four employees who, by the way, work piecework. They get paid by how fast they can make the clothes. Her name is Barbara. She's terrific. She's an architect by training, but she's doing this because she can make more money, because she said she was making $9 a month. And now she's in business for herself and doing better than that. She sold the apartment she was in a bad neighborhood, bought a new apartment, used her architectural skills in remodeling the apartment. And her factory is on the landing between the first and second floor of her apartment. And if you look closely, you'll see that the sewing machine on the right is a pedal-powered sewing machine, like your grandmother had, maybe, right? Pedal power. The woman on the right is the wife of Julio Alvarez, Nuris. That's her car that he has restored. She calls the car Lola. And she's out. She runs the business. The husband restores the car. She runs the business, and she runs. They've now got 20 cars that they're operating. By the way, you're only allowed to own one, to operate one taxi. So the husband owns one. She owns one. Their 10-year-old son owns one. All of their, gaming the government is not something we only do in the U.S. And she's terrific. This is Sergio. He develops apps, apps that would seem out of date in the U.S., but which are cutting edge in Cuba. These two gentlemen give lectures. The guy on the left is a retired diplomat and university professor. The guy on the right is a economics professor at the University of Havana. They make more for each lecture. I mean, the guy's retired, obviously does, but the guy who's a university professor makes more for each lecture than he does in a month as a university professor, right? The gentleman on the left is a street entertainer. The guy on the right, Alexei, is half of a hip-hop duo, which is the most important hip-hop band in Cuba, who knew there was one, called Obsesión. The gentleman on the left with the bald head runs a beauty parlor. He also runs a school to train beauty parlor operators. And he considers himself a social entrepreneur. He works with a school for the deaf and trains deaf students to be beauty parlor operators for free. And the photo on the right, the woman with the black top runs a restaurant, actually a terrific restaurant, L'Atelier, if you're there, I recommend it. The woman on the left in the turquoise top used to be a professor at the University of Havana. She now runs an event planning business. She said her university colleagues were appalled that she would leave something as prestigious as being a university professor to run an event planning business, which essentially is quinceañeras, the parties that every girl in Latin America has when they turn 15. And she says now they're calling her and asking for jobs. They're calling her and asking for jobs. She's got 20 employees, not on contract. So, you have the party, she hires the photographer, the clown, the this, the that, the other. Her supply chain is to fly to Miami with an empty suitcase once a month and go to the party store and buy the stuff you need, and then she goes back and pays duties on it when she returns. I mean, it's legal. Everything she's doing is legal. But that's her supply chain because there's nowhere to buy balloons in Havana, right? Artists, the gentleman on the left is the painter. Those are his paintings in the background. His wife is a sculptor, and you can see part of one of her sculptures on the floor there. I don't understand modern art, so I won't tell you what it is. And then on the right is an art gallery. Cuban cigars are famous. These are farmers in the western part of Cuba where the tobacco lands are. The gentleman on the right is just happy as can be because he says, I'm on the main road, I can see it. He's building a second tobacco barn now because he's got to sell a certain percentage of his crop to the state. But what's left over, he can roll cigars and sell cigars to all the tourists coming through, and he's working on getting rooms in his house that he can rent out as well. And so he's making more money now than he ever has. Okay. And it's these people, when I say the embargo within the embargo, who would love the ability to expand. If you have a restaurant, you can only have one restaurant. You can't have a second restaurant. It has to be in your home. You can't rent a place for a restaurant. If you're a farmer, you don't own the land. You have a contract with the state that gives you use of the land for 50 years, but not ownership of the land, so that you can't sell it, you can't mortgage it. You can't mortgage it because no bank, there are no mortgages, so you couldn't do that in any case. The woman that makes baby clothes, her supply chain is to fly to Ecuador, buy the material she needs in Ecuador, and fly back. Cubans don't need visas to go to Ecuador, so it's easier for her to do that. Everybody that she would love to expand, she can't rent a place to have a factory, so it's in her home. You're just not allowed to do it. They have just started giving loans to private sector businesses, but they tend to be $500 loans. I mean, it's not really the loan that you need to start a business. So a foreign diplomat in Havana said, look, if they would, not U.S., says they could probably add another 100,000 jobs in Havana alone by opening up the private sector to do home repair, by allowing contract, you know, to allow you to contract with somebody who then would contact and bring in the plumber and the guy to replace the windows and do all the other stuff that you need to repair your place where you live. But that's what they haven't done. That's what people had hoped would happen at the Party Congress, and that is what has not happened. So that's Cuba. And that's the embargo, and that's the embargo within the embargo. So let me give you an idea here. I mean, this, I hope you're close enough that you can read this yourself. United States exports to Cuba about $300 million a year of food. Food was taken out of the embargo. Agricultural products were taken out of the embargo, I think, in 2001. And that gives you some idea. The United States exports that much to Canada, $300 million, every 9 hours. I mean, that's the difference in scale between Canada and Cuba. And that's who we do business with. And that's going to, until Cuba opens up itself to foreign business, opens up itself to Cuban business, trade with Cuba is going to be very, very difficult. And I want to thank you all very much.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you very, very much. So hopefully everyone has put in their vote. A, you agree, B, you're neutral, and C, you disagree. We only have a few more minutes. The ambassador has agreed to take some questions from the audience. If you could please wait for the microphone so that we can have it recorded for our radio listener audience. Just raise your hand high and Kari will come to you with a microphone.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming so far to visit with us. I was interested in Sergio with his application for the cell phones. I think that the feed currently is coming through Venezuela to provide internet to Cuba. And would it not be a possibility to use a satellite or airborne platform to provide wireless connectivity, thus alleviating the need to have an intermediary to these prospective entrepreneurs on the ground?
The answer is yeah, of course. And what even more economical is there's an undersea fiber optic cable from the U.S. that runs right offshore Cuba. And President Obama, one of the things that he announced was, I mean, we had said before that we would be fine with a U.S. business hooking, you know, that would be exempt from the embargo, is to hook Cuba up into that fiber optic cable. But businesses were afraid to do so, Judge, because they thought they would, you know, run into compliance issues with the embargo. So what the president did in January 2015 was issue explicit executive order that, you know, if Cisco or whoever it is wants to provide the connector that would hook and the computer equipment to hook that fiber optic cable up to the Cuban phone company, that they would not run into legal issues in the U.S. But there's a saying that it takes two to tango. So the Cubans have to take them up on it. I mean, it's legal to do it, but the Cubans have to agree, right? The Cubans have to agree. One of the great changes in Cuba, by the way, really extraordinary changes, is Wi-Fi accessibility. So what they have done over the past 2 years, I mean, this is really new. I mean, for a long time, there was only Wi-Fi at hotels where there were foreign tourists. And there were what we would call internet cafes at the post offices around the country. So you could reserve, you know, and you have 15 minutes on a computer. People, let me back up a little bit. I apologize for getting wonky on you. If you were a professor or a doctor, people had internet access at work, but only for things related to work, right? So, you know, you're a cancer researcher, you have internet access to do cancer research, or you're an economics professor, you could do that. But what Wi-Fi does is lets you connect to anything. And so what they've done in the past 2 years is they've set up Wi-Fi hotspots in parks all over the country, in public parks. And what I found out on my last trip was the Wi-Fi access was better in the park than it was in the hotel. So I'm out sitting with my cell phone in the park with all the kids, checking my email, right? But what's interesting about it is, and to their credit, if everybody I talk to, in my own experience, is they do not censor where you can go on the internet. Those of you who've been to China know the Chinese do, right? So you can do Twitter, you can go to the New York Times, you can do Facebook, you can do all of that. And interestingly, I mean, just this is anecdotal, I mean, you see people in the parks and they are Skyping with family members who are overseas. And so it is phenomenal because this island, which has been cut off from the rest of the world in terms of media since 1959, really now is opened up. I mean, one of the things when I first started going to Cuba in the 1990s is that people had no idea what was going on in the outside world, because the only way they had of knowing was through the newspaper that's published by the Cuban Communist Party and by the TV stations that are controlled by the Cuban Communist Party. And now they have access to the rest of the world, and that is an extraordinary change.
So it's tempting to think that most working class Cubans would be thrilled at the idea of the U.S. lifting the embargo. But I'm curious in learning more about like the factions in Cuba that are resistant to that change. I mean, who are they? Are they party insiders, Raul Castro? Who are the factions resistant to that?
That's a great question. Do I need to repeat questions? Can anybody hear them? Yeah. Okay, fine. First of all, there was over enthusiasm in the U.S. on the part of U.S. businesses, you know, there's this huge bonanza in Cuba. Ordinary Cuban citizens thought that their life, their standard of living, their income was going to improve overnight as the U.S. and Cuba got closer. And of course, that hasn't happened. There is no polling data from Cuba. Cuban leadership doesn't give interviews. So when people tell you they know what Raul Castro is thinking, they are extrapolating. They're guessing from what he said at his speech at the party Congress. So here I'm going to tell you that, and I'm going to start out by saying everything I'm telling you may be absolutely wrong, okay? Number one, it is generally believed that Raul Castro is more pragmatic than his brother Fidel, okay? He's a military guy. He spent his whole career in the Ministry of Defense, and military everywhere, you know, tend to be mission-oriented. You know, you tell them to do something, and they figure out, well, how many trucks, how many gallons of gasoline, how many troops, how many bulldozers do I need to accomplish that? And that his focus is much more, you know, this isn't working, how do we improve it? By the way, at the same time, he's quite clear, and he said it when President Obama was there, and he said it even more strongly the week after President Obama left in March, that we have no intention of changing our system, right? We have no intention of changing our system. And the American business people, when they go to Cuba, you know, we love to think we're pragmatic, and so we all assume that Cuba will copy the Chinese or the Vietnamese, communist countries which have maintained the control of the political system by the Communist Party but have opened the economy. And the Cubans are very clear that they are not going to do that, that they consider the Chinese and the Vietnamese to be, to put it in religious terms, backsliders. And, you know, their line, which sounds remarkably like Winston Churchill, is, you know, we didn't have this revolution to bring private enterprise back to Cuba, right? We're not going to give it away. So you've got that. Is they want to do it in a controlled way where they maintain control. Okay, so who's opposed to it? There is supposed to be, but again, is this true? I don't know. The mid-level party bureaucrats, you know, who are doing fine. Who are called in Cuban Spanish, they call them the dinosaurs, the people who don't want change, and they're the ones who don't want change, and that they're very resistant. And as we know, I mean, whether you're in business or you work for government, is your boss can tell you to do something, and if you don't want to do it, it doesn't happen, right? You can drag your feet. You cannot implement the new plan, right? And that's a large part of what appears to be going on in Cuba. Is these people who want to protect their own positions are dragging their feet. Oh, I'm sorry, I don't get to choose.
Thank you for a very humorous presentation and a very fair presentation. Question arose in my mind when you talked about a couple of the major accomplishments, which is universal education, universal health. And I was thinking, well, is it the cost of these items that, you know, which is that fact a domestic issue in the United States? Is it that cost that stops the economy from growing, or is it the administration oversight, the overreach of the central government? And if it's the second, as I suspect you'd say, then what is the are there two or three things that they could do that could make a major change?
Yes and yes. Okay, yeah, I mean, you know, how much you want to spend on health and how much you want to spend in education, we consider matter public policy, right? And I assume that is what your state legislature argues about at each session, right? Certainly what Congress argues about in Washington. And I can guarantee you it's what the Georgia legislature argues about at our annual sessions. So that's something that we would argue ought to be decided by the political system, by something surging from the bottom up, not from the top down. The bigger issue, to my way of thinking, is how do you open up the economy so that the economy's growing, there's more tax revenue and all the other things, which actually might enable you to be able to pay for education and health. And you know, what are two or three things you could do? Well, you could take 201 businesses that are allowed, and you could increase that number to 600 or 1,000 businesses that are allowed to operate without intervention from the state. That's fairly simple. In the U.S., we have a negative system. You can go into any business you want to, except for bank robbery, right? I mean, you know, there are things that are outlawed. You know, if you want to be a real estate agent, you need to have some sort of license to be a real estate agent, but nobody says you can't be a real estate agent if you can pass the test. Or you can be a lawyer if you go to law school, get a law degree, and you can pass the bar exam. In Cuba, you can be a lawyer, but you can't go into private practice. You can only be a lawyer for the state. So one of the tour guides that we have, you have to have a tour guide. If you rent a bus, you have to hire a tour guide, and all tour guides are state employees. The tour guide was a lawyer who quit being a lawyer because he can make more money as a tour guide because he gets tips at the end of the week, right, from all the people on the bus. We had a meeting with the, I think he was the vice minister of tourism. And so, you know, he's answering questions. I raised my hand. I said, so when can David be a tour guide on his own? I mean, why does he have to be a tour guide for the state? What an easy thing to do, right? And he laughed it off as a joke, you know, that how could you ask such a crazy question, right? I mean, why can't you? I assume tour guides in Alaska don't work for the state of Alaska, that they're privately employed, right? I mean, why can't you do that? I mean, that would open it up. Give loans to private businesses. Allow businesses to own more than one business, right? So that the good, successful restaurateur has three or four restaurants instead of one restaurant, right? People can rent rooms in their own homes, but you can't own a hotel. Cubans. I mean, why can't you own a hotel? There are no middlemen in Cuba, except for the state. If you're in private business, you know, you're the guy restoring cars, you cannot import parts directly, and the state won't import them for you. Let the guy order the parts through the state, okay, through the state transport agency or freight agency or something like that, so he could go down to the port and pick them up. There you go. Can't do that. If you're a farmer, I don't know how it works in Alaska, but everywhere I've ever been, you know, if you go to the county seat, you know, there's a feed store there, right? There are places where you can buy fertilizer and you can buy spare parts for the tractor and you can, you know, buy seeds and buy all the stuff that you need. That doesn't exist in Cuba. The state runs all of that. There's great organic farming because there is no fertilizer. You know. The list of things that they could do that, to my way of thinking, would not threaten the primacy of the Communist Party, right, are endless. There also are no NGOs in Cuba. Okay, so the World Affairs Council of Alaska does not exist in Cuba. There are no Rotary Clubs. There's no Kiwanis Clubs. There's no PTA. The Boy Scouts are run by the state. The only non-governmental organization in Cuba is the Catholic Church. Bam. Okay, so allow neighbors to organize to clean up the trash in the neighborhood. Wouldn't that be cool? I don't think that threatens, one would not think that that would threaten the primacy of the Communist Party. But in fact, from their perspective, it does. And so how do they get over that? You know, at some point, you know, how far do you go? The Chinese and the Vietnamese have moved in that direction, right? And you just heard on the radio, Chinese cracking down on religions, right? Religious organizations. I mean, that's a source of tension in a communist country because Cuba has got lots of interesting things, but let's be honest, it's a dictatorship, right? More questions?
I have a two-part question. Has Donald Trump signed up for your April business tour yet?
Nope.
And if he does, if he decides to set up a business in Cuba, will it be legal this time?
Ooh, okay. I just saw that this morning. I saw the headline. I didn't read the article, and I'm going to let y'all answer that. Going down and looking at I'm going to answer your question a different way. Yes, you can make money in Cuba in transportation. So your Alaska Airlines is going to start a flight from L.A. directly into Havana. They're going to make money, I assume, doing that, or they'll drop the route. I mean, Delta Airlines is going to fly directly from Atlanta starting December 1. That is terrific, and presumably Delta will make money or they'll drop the route. You can make money in telecommunications industry. So if you were willing to hook up that fiber optic cable, you'll make money. I mean, when you go to Cuba, and if you're
anybody from the outside. I mean, you look around, I mean, everybody driving their car in Atlanta, certainly not in Anchorage, but in Atlanta is, you know, reading their cell phone while they're driving, right? I mean, you can't do that. You can't stay connected. You can't, if you're a business executive and you're in Cuba, you can't answer the questions from your office because the connectivity is so bad. So you can make money increasing connectivity. Starwood has just gotten permission. They're going to remodel and rebuild a hotel. I mean, tourists in Cuba have money. Cubans in Cuba do not have money. So you want to go, I mean, that's pretty basic business. You want to go where the money is, and that means do things that cater to foreign tourists. Airbnb operates in Cuba. And they operate in Cuba because they don't have to deal with the government of Cuba. I mean, it's terrific. Okay, so if Lisa were a Cuban, and great, it's a good Spanish name, Lisa, and she's got a room to rent in her house, she would have to deal with the government of Cuba and get a license, and she would have to pay taxes depending on how many people per month stay in her house and how much she charges them. But she doesn't have the bandwidth to put up an advertisement for her house on the internet. So what you would do is you would work with Airbnb, you take photos of your house. Airbnb, obviously, that's what it's an advertisement, right? Look at Lisa's house versus my house versus somebody else's house, how much it costs, where it's located, does it have a private bath, you know, all the stuff that people are looking at for. And you, as an American, pay Airbnb online in the U.S. before you go to Cuba, right? So you don't have to deal with the absence of U.S. banks in Cuba. So then Airbnb collects the money. Airbnb sends the money to Lisa through Western Union, which has been operating in Cuba for decades, and it's legal to do. And so she gets her money. I get to stay in the fabulous room in her fabulous house, right? Airbnb takes a cut out of that, so they make the money. And, you know, there you go. So Airbnb is making money in Cuba. They claim that it is their fastest growing market. Now, it's starting from a very low base, but it's their fastest growing market is Cuba. So that's where you can make money in Cuba, whether you're Donald Trump or you're not, to go back to where you started.
Thank you for listening to Addressing Alaskans today on Alaska Public Media. We've been listening to former Ambassador Charles Shapiro. And just a reminder that his presentation titled Cuba, The Embargo Within the Embargo, can be found on our website at alaskapublic.org. This event took place on September 30th at the Hilton Hotel. For KSKA Anchorage, I'm Eric Bork.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. The views expressed are those of the hosts and participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.